Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Welcome to the Wild Tales podcast. I'm Jason Fox, and this series is all about adventure, resilience, and inspirational humans. The podcast is presented by the Book of Man and in partnership with Talisker, a single malt whiskey made by the sea. My guest today is Tracy Edwards, MBE, a British sailor with an incredible story. She inspired a generation of women when she skippered the first all-female crew in the Whitbread Round the World Yacht Race, as seen in last year's documentary film, Maiden. She now runs the Maiden Factor, which has used the original vessel from 1989 to tour the globe to raise awareness for women's rights in developing countries. Tracy is a truly remarkable and determined individual. In the episode, we answer some questions that you've asked me on Instagram. I'm going to be sending a bottle of Talisker to the top question. In addition, malts.com are offering a 10% off promo code, which is Talisker15DE. That's all in uppercase. Redeemable at checkout on www.malts.com until the 1st of October 2020. Discount may only be used once for individual Talisker Distillers Edition products for sale at £100 or less. No minimum spend, but a delivery charge may apply. Not to be used in conjunction with any other offer, and gift card purchases are excluded. 18 plus and subject to malts.com terms of sale. Anyway, here we go, and I hope you enjoy it. Hi, everyone. Welcome again to another podcast, Wild Tales. We're doing it remotely because of the crisis reading, except this time it's a little bit more remotely because I'm in Sydney, Australia. And my next guest, the legend that is Tracy Edwards, is in Putney, if I'm right. So, hi, Tracy. How's it going?
Yeah, it's okay. It's I'm not entirely sure what the answer is to that question at the moment, but some days are good, some days not so great, but same as everyone else, I guess.
Yeah, how has lockdown been for you? I know we're sort of like we're at the tail end of something, hopefully, but who knows what's around the corner. But yeah, how's it been anyway, the last few months?
Yeah, it was a bit of a shame really, because we spent the whole of last year with Maiden doing her world tour, kind of setting 2020 up to be a huge year for us. And so in March we were literally just about to head off from the Caribbean. Well, not we, my amazing team in Maiden. We were about to head off to the east coast of the States, and we were supposed to spend the whole summer there, you know, big fundraisers and all load of stuff we were doing with schools and communities. And of course the day before they left, I had to say, nope, you're gonna have to get yourselves home. And we had to get Maiden back to the UK. So for us, it's been hard changing our mindset. You know, we've had to change from full-on excitement to, okay, we have to deal with this and completely reschedule everything. But again, the same as everyone else.
Yeah, exactly. I think that's one of the things you can take from it, is like a lot of the time when things go wrong, you're like, oh, damn, you know, I'm in this on my own. But this time, it's the same for everyone, which is, there's a bit of comfort that comes from that, isn't there? I suppose.
Yeah, you know, we are all in the same boat. Ha ha. Pardon the pun.
Yeah, there we go. So I don't want to jump the gun, because obviously we're going to get to, I like to move through things chronologically. We're going to get to, you know, where you were before lockdown and what that was all about. But I'm interested in always starting at the beginning. You know, I'd love you to explain a bit about your childhood and how you sort of became this legend, or where did the interest come from in being on the water?
Well, there was absolutely zero interest at all, I have to say, from me. My dad, who was a sailor, desperately tried to get me into sailing. And when I was about 8 years old, he took me in this tiny, what I thought was a tiny sailing yacht, from the mainland to the Isle of Wight. I was horribly seasick and vowed to live on the Isle of Wight for the rest of my life, so I would never have to get back in another boat again. My dad died when I was 10, which changed my life forever, really. My mum remarried, and not a very nice person. But one actually good thing that he did was he moved us down to Wales. So I grew up in at the end of the Gower Peninsula, which is quite wild and remote. Nice. And yeah, so I grew up on a farm with horses and a beach and hillsides, and for a kid it was idyllic. But my father, my stepfather and I had quite a volatile and physical relationship. And I was being bullied at school. So I went from a really, I'd say quite cute girl to a nightmare from hell. My poor mother, oh my God. So I didn't tell her what was going on. I became aggressive and angry and violent. Staying out all night, climbing out of my bedroom window. I stole a car. I was arrested. I mean, I just went from this wonderful middle-class child to this total nightmare. And in the end, I was expelled from school when I was 15. I have to say, my headmaster, his patience up until then had been quite extraordinary. And I, you know, had no exams, no qualifications. Oh, I don't know what I want to do. And it was my mum who suggested that I go backpacking to Greece, where we had a friend who owned a piano bar in Piraeus, you know, the port. And so off I went at the age of 16. And I look at my daughter at the age of 16 when she was, and I just thought there's no way I would let her go on. But she was right. I needed to get away from where I was and go and find who I was. And my mum was an extraordinary woman and took a lot of courage to do that. Ended up working in a bar in Greece, as you do. A guy came in one night to the bar and said, would you like to work on my boat? I was 17 then, and I just went, yeah, okay. And so off I went on this charter as a stewardess. And within 4 days, I thought, this is what I'm going to do for the rest of my life. Not the stewardessing, I have to say, that was horrendous. But the sailing. Me was I found what I was supposed to do.
Yeah, I mean, going back there, obviously you said looking at your daughter when she was 16, you couldn't think about packing her off on a sort of like a holiday. But I think when you look at your daughter when she's 16, was she as badly behaved as you were?
No, thank goodness. No, my daughter took after my mother, thank God, and I took after my grandmother. So my daughter's got a really tough time with hers coming up when she has one. So yeah, it skips a generation, luckily for me.
Yeah. Okay, cool. So what was the stewardessing that you originally did in the beginning? What sort of boat were you on to begin with?
I was actually on a motor yacht to start off with, which of course is a swear word in the sailing world. But it was a great start for me because more than the ocean, which I came to appreciate later, and more than the lifestyle, which came later, for me, it was the first time I had ever belonged to a group of people. It was the first time I'd ever felt I wasn't on the outside looking in. I was actually on the inside of something amazing. And all of these people, we'd all kind of ended up there, you know, and we were all this sort of ragtag bunch of, gypsies and nomads and all looking for something, mostly running away from something, if I'm honest. But you know, we were this strange, all of the boats that I've ever been on, we've been this sort of bizarre family unit, which of course is what I didn't have at home. And these people accepted me, you know, warts and all. And so for me, that was the thing that drew me to it. The work is hard, you know, you're working on a charter yacht, it's back-to-back chartering with some very wealthy, very demanding, often people who like things done a certain way, but you're learning all the time. And you know, on every boat I've ever had, I've had great mentors. Every one of my skippers and my cooks were always saying to me, you know, you can do more than this. Why don't you try, you know, push yourself? And, you know, so my second transatlantic, the skipper said to me, can you navigate? And I went, of course I can't navigate. I was, you know, expelled before long division, for God's sake. So he said to me, well, what happens if I fall over the side? And I said, well, there's two other guys on the boat. They can't navigate. I said, well, I'll use the electronic thingy, you know. He said, well, what if the batteries go? I'm like, oh, for goodness sake. He said, why are you being a bystander in your own life? He said, you're supposed to be playing the starring role. I'm like, God, it's a bit profound for 2 days into the Atlantic.
But I like it.
Yeah, I don't, but it was one of the best pieces of advice I've ever been given, because I was coasting, you know, I was having fun and it's all great. And then I was coasting, and he taught me to navigate in 2 days. And if someone had told me that someone could teach me not to see numbers as hieroglyphics, I would have never believed them. But once I'd learned to navigate, for me, then that was it. I knew this was the job I wanted to do, and not just the sailing, but the navigation. For me, that magic, that wonder of finding out wherever you are in the world with a sextant, a book of tables, and a pencil.
It's weird that, do you know what? I don't mean to interrupt this story, everyone, but I'm actually, because I'm sat in quarantine, going out of my mind, I'm reading a book at the moment called Wayfinding, and it's about the human's relationship with losing and finding their way. It's unbelievable. It's by a bloke called Michael Bond, I think. It's really good to read. And it's about, from the dawn of time, how people have always, how it can actually, not knowing where you are, can have a massive impact on your mental headspace. Do you know what I mean? And you see people, absolutely, when they get lost, they go into an absolute flat spin. And you know, in my sort of relationship with being at sea is a lot less than yours, but I have been in those situations where you're sometimes wondering where you are and you've got to try and work it out quickly and to keep yourself in a good place. Do you know what I mean?
I think you're right. I mean, that is a very human condition, needing to center yourself before you can move forward.
Yeah, definitely. But who was that skipper then? Do you remember his
name was Julian Gildersleeve, and the boat was White Quailer. It was a 46-foot swan, and it changed my life forever. I mean, it was such a profound moment in my life. And it really was the first time I thought I wasn't an idiot, because when I did maths at school, you know, I was an idiot and I couldn't do anything. Sit at the back of the class and shut up and stop being disruptive. You know, if my teacher had said to me, if you learn maths, you can be a pirate, I would have gone, okay, I'll learn maths, you know. So it was just having that, I need a reason, you know, to do stuff.
Yeah, so then obviously that being the second transatlantic trip was obviously an extremely defining moment in your life. When did the sort of, obviously you're now, as far as I can read into this now, the fact, the point that you're part of a small team that has a common goal, you know, it's getting from A to B essentially most of the time, and that's in that world. But when did the racing side of things come into play?
Well, when you're in this weird traveling circus, and you've got the seasons, you know, you've got the Med, the Indian Ocean, the Caribbean. So you follow the seasons on different boats and you chop and you change. And I began to realize that all of these other people on these other boats, you know, sort of they would have this other thing, you know, sort of something they would do at the weekend. And most of the time it was racing. And again, I was like, I'm so lucky with the boats that I've been on, and, you know, sort of the progression of things. And so one weekend in Antigua, I found myself racing on a weekend race and just thought, God, this is great. And I discovered I was competitive, because up until then I've been, you know, just completely laid back, but no goals, no vision, no future, you know. And so racing for me made me feel, oh my goodness, there's a purpose to this and I want to win. And that was surprising. And again, very lucky, I was on great boats. I learned, you know, it's a weird, so sailing is kind of two sections, if you like. There's the charter world, which is where you don't notice the sexism, because the men are the skippers, the women are the cooks, the girls are the stewardesses, and the boys are the deckhand. It's just how it is, like a family. But when you get into racing, that's when you start to realize, oh, there's only some things I'm allowed to do in this scenario. So I'm not allowed to get on the wheel, I'm not allowed to do that. That for me was the first indication that here was something I really enjoyed, but I couldn't kind of go all the way with it. And not that I necessarily wanted to, but it was, it just flagged it up for me. And then it was again, actually, Julian, who said to me, you know, you seem to love this racing. I've done the Whitbread Round the World race. Why don't you sort of have a look at doing that? So I said, oh, what's that? They gave me this book called Cape Horn's Port, which was again to change my life. And I just read from cover to cover and went, I have to do this. And 2 weeks later, a boat sailed into the harbour that was doing the Whitbread. It was just like, you know, sort of dropped into my lap. I got on this boat to do the first leg of the Whitbread. This was the 85-86 Whitbread, but I didn't like it. Skipper scared me, and I didn't feel safe. And that was the first time I felt safe at sea. So in Cape Town, I got off and wondered what to do next. And then the guys on Atlantic Privateer, which was the most badly behaved boat in the entire race. I mean, they were called the Pirates for a reason.
I love the sound of them already. This is awesome.
Well, they were just mad. I've been friends with them for ages, but it's very different being friends with people on land, being on a boat with them, as you well know. So they said, look, we've lost our cook, you know, what do you think? And the skipper didn't want me, he didn't want me on the boat. The owner said, let's have you on the boat. Let's see what happens, you know. So I became the first woman to get on an Ocean Racing Maxi in the Whitbread. But the first leg was horrendous. I mean, absolutely horrendous. They threatened to throw me over the side. The first thing they did was say, right, so what we do on each leg is we see how long we can all go without washing, and the winner gets a crate of beer. And I'm like, what have I let myself in for? I did actually win, though, so I felt I had to. It was a point I had to prove. But then when we got to port, one of the guys lasted another 2 days, you know, so you're like, oh, no. So it was a baptism of fire, but I learned, you know, these guys, they may have been rough and tough and everything else, but, I mean, they'll hate me for saying this, but all of them had a soft side, and they all taught me something. And if I wanted to, how does that work? They'd sit and teach me. And so we won that leg. So I then became a lucky charm to have on the boat. Getting a date was a nightmare because I had 17 older brothers. So that was just awful. But I got to the end of this race and I just thought, well, that is the world's best kept secret, because before the race, there were three women out of 260 crew, and 35 years ago. And before the race, everyone had been saying to me, oh, it's really hard. It's oof, you won't last. And at the end, I thought, it's not that hard. This is, you know, this is like the ultimate man shed at the bottom of the garden. Don't go there. So I thought, I want to do the race again, but I want to do it as a navigator, not as a cook. You know, I'm a better navigator than I am a cook. My daughter will definitely agree with that. And then I had this, probably the second most profound thought I had in my life, which was, no man will ever let me on a boat as a navigator, ever. So my mum said, well, how do you change that then? You know, you don't like the world, the way the world looks, change it. And I thought, how do I change this? And I thought, well, I'll have to have my own team. I'll have to have my own boat, and it should be a team of women so that we can prove that women can race around the world. And then I can be the navigator. So it was quite a selfish reason that I set Maiden up. It didn't start out being, whoa, you know, fighting for women's rights. It was, I want to be a navigator. And so that's how Maiden came to being, with me wanting to do something I was told I couldn't do.
You say it's selfish, but ultimately everyone wants to do something. And in your case, you know, especially back then, being a female who wanted to navigate, you had to be selfish, which in turn helped generations of women after you. So yeah, I get what you're saying, but in the same breath, I'd suggest that you're not selfish and it's been a good thing. But anyway, we're not at the end of the story. So that was the idea and the concept of, we're leading up to 1989, aren't we?
Yeah, the 1989-90 Whitbread, which was the best of all the Whitbreads in my humble opinion.
So how did it all become a reality? You know, from that, the concept of, right, I want to be a navigator, but and I need to find a load of women that want to come with me. Yeah. And a boat. How was this? The most important part is, well, they all are, everything's important, but obviously a boat is quite essential
essential, yeah. Well, I met this guy called Howard Gibbons, who was a yachting journalist, who said, well, I'll give you a hand. And we sat in the pub and literally back of a beer mat, we worked out, you know, budget, what do we need, you know, boat, crew and all this other thing. I mean, it staggers me how little we knew about what we were doing, but that was probably a good thing. What did happen, though, was I realised I'd learned much more on the 85-86 Whitbread than I realised. I'd learned how to manage a yacht. I'd learned how to provision. I'd learned, you know, all of these different things, which just suddenly came into play. And so the two of us literally put the project together. We realised we needed a couple of million pounds. I mean, we were at that point going to design and build a brand new yacht like everyone else. But what I had not reckoned with was the opposition to what we wanted to do. I thought a couple of people would say, oh, girls can't do that, and we'd go, yes they can, and we'd just get on with it. But the opposition was anger and so vociferous, you know. It was you know, I literally had a guy walk up to me in the pub one night, jab his finger almost into my face and say, you're going to die. I'm like, okay, but that's kind of my business. It doesn't affect you in any way at all. So it was. But again, you know, as these things often turn out, this wave of opposition ended up really galvanizing me. And that's when I thought, oh, I'm not just doing this for me. I'm doing this for women everywhere. This is not acceptable. So, you know, that's really, that really kind of made me do it. I often wonder if people have said, oh, that's a good idea. Would I have just gone, oh, that's a bit boring. I'll go and do something else. So we fought every step of the way. Every day we fought. And we are.
What were the organisers of the event like towards the idea?
Interestingly, actually, the event was run by the Royal Naval Sailing Association and, God, those were the days, the amateur days of sailing. And Admiral Admiral Sir Charles Williams, who was this terribly proper admiral in the Royal Navy, thought he would be our biggest problem. Not a bit of it. There were people in the race that went to him and said, we don't think we want an all-female crew in the race. You know, they're going to be a liability. We're always going to be rescuing them. God, how insulting. And it was Admiral Charles Williams who said, I think they're going to do it. And I think this is a jolly good idea. So he let us enter the race, which, you know, he could have prevented us from doing. It was more from, and then I have to say, the guys within the actual fleet then started coming around. And I mean, when we had to buy a secondhand boat called Prestige, which had already been around twice before, we couldn't afford a new boat. No one would give us sponsorship. No one would help us. No one would give us money. So we bought this secondhand boat. I remortgaged my house. We found this ship in Cape Town where we bought the boat. And we said, could you put our boat on the top of your containers and get her to the UK? Thank God you couldn't do that now. So we got the boat to the UK and then we put her in a boatyard and we did the work. We had no money. So we literally walked into the boatyard with sledgehammers to take the boat apart, to redesign her, to put her back together again. And that was the point where people went, I think they're quite serious about this. And the guys in the yard were brilliant. You know, someone gave us an engine, we've got a generator from another boat. Someone said, we've got some spare rigging. Do you want that? Yep, I'll have that. You know, I mean, we got some secondhand paint from the naval dockyard to paint her.
Whereabouts was the boat kept, sorry?
In Hamble, so on the south coast of the UK. And while all this was going on, we were raising money, women were arriving literally at my front door going, I want to sail around the world. The team was starting to come together. We started out with a nucleus of women who were to last the whole 2 years of the project. And again, for me, that was really important because one of the last things got flung at us was women don't get on. And I was like, where does that come from? You know, it comes from men who don't want women to get on. So all of us staying together as a team was really important. And Peter Blake had the only other team who stayed together as long. And he came first and we came second. So, you know, it was a fight to the start line. But again, you know, something which was a disadvantage ended up being an advantage because by the time we got to the start line, we were battle hardened. We had to fight every inch of the way to get to that start line. From then on, we knew what we were doing. We knew we could do the next bit. All of the other guys, you know, they jump on their big shiny boats, you know, and off they go. And so I always felt that we had something that they, through no fault of their own, didn't have. And then, of course, the final piece of the jigsaw puzzle was when King Hussein of Jordan came in as a sponsor, and Royal Jordanian Airlines ended up being our sponsor, which is why she used the beautiful grey colour, because that's the colour of their planes.
How did that come about? That relationship, and I mean, what was it? Did he just find out about the story and felt it was inspiring? And No,
I met him when I was 21, as I was a stewardess on a charter boat that he chartered in Newport, Rhode Island, and we became friends. And King Hussein, one of the most amazing human beings that has ever walked this earth, and we sorely miss him right now, I have to say. He was a collector of people, and he collects people from all over the world, from different classes, colours, creeds, ethnicity, religions. And I was doing the washing up, and I turned around, and there's King Hussein standing there with a tea towel, and I just went, I don't think you can do that. He said, I can do anything I like, I'm king. I'm like, okay. So he was drying up, I'm washing up. He said, I'm so fascinated with this life that you have. He said, you're like a Bedouin, which of course I didn't know what a huge compliment that was at the time. We started talking about taking radios apart. And as I was probably one of the saddest people I knew at that point, I loved taking things apart and putting them back together again. We loved communication. We both loved navigation. He's a pilot. He was a ham radio operator. So we just had this instant connection and we stayed in touch. And then he followed the 85-86 Whitbread and we would call him from the boat, much to the amusement of the guys who thought this was just brilliant. And when we got to the end and I decided to do Maiden, the first person I told was Mum. And then I flew over to Jordan to stay with King Hussein and his family. And he was the second person I told. And him and my mum really were the people that said to me, you can do this. If you put your mind to this, you can absolutely achieve this. And he was always there in the background. I'd call him up and, I mean, I can't imagine what phone calls I interrupted, but I would call him up and say, I'm a bit worried, I'm a bit nervous, or I can't get to this point. And he would advise me. And when it got to 2 months before the start of the race and we still didn't have a sponsor, he just said, oh, this is ridiculous. You know, Royal Jordanian Airlines will be your sponsor. And it did raise a few eyebrows. I mean, everyone was like, Arab airline, bunch of girls. Yeah, no, we don't get it. But of course, for him, it was a natural because he believed in gender equality, religious equality, equality of colour, religion, you know, everything. He had this vision of a peaceful world where we all got on and, you know, he worked very hard to try and make that happen. So we sailed around the world with a message of peace and equality, which was 30 years ago, the first time anyone had ever done that.
That's unbelievable. I love the link with the Jordanians and especially the king, because obviously it's a remarkable country, to be fair. Yeah. Anyway, if anyone doesn't know much about Jordan, have a look at it, because if you look at where they are and who surrounds them, they've managed to keep pretty sane through a lot of things, for a lot of bad things as well. But just so going back to the race, before we get into the nitty gritty of it, because I know that there's plenty of stories and thing of, you know, and we all want to hear about stuff where it got a bit hairy, but can you just, and the potential for this answer to be very long is easy, it's there, but where does it start and what is the route briefly?
Okay, so it's not dissimilar actually to the route behind me, which is what Maiden's just done now. But so the first leg was from the UK. Now this was when the 89-90 race was sanctions were now in place for South Africa because of apartheid, so that couldn't be a stopover. So the first leg was from the UK down to Uruguay on the South American coast. That was about 5,000 miles and took about 4 weeks. The next leg, the second leg, which is the real killer, was the longest leg the Whitbread had ever had because we couldn't stop in South Africa. So that was 7,800 miles long, which is five to six, 7 weeks at sea. And that goes right into the Southern Ocean. And these were in the days where there were no rules about going, you can't go too far south because of the iceberg. So these were in the rules where it's just like, fill your boots, go wherever you want to go, which was great for a navigator before the days of health and safety. And so that finishes in Australia. And then you've got a short hop, 3,400 miles from Australia to New Zealand, which is a tactical leg. And then back into the Southern Ocean, back to Uruguay, and then up the coast, South America, North America to Fort Lauderdale in America, and then a transatlantic back to the UK. So it's 9 months, it's 33,000 miles, and you're at sea. Well, we were at sea for a total of 167 days out of the 9 months.
Unbelievable. Would you? How long are the stop-offs? You know, when you stop off, and you obviously you need to sort of a little bit of rest and recuperation and resupply. How long is there a set time? Do you have to sort of, as soon as you're in, you then the clock starts before you then head off again?
Yeah, so varying lengths. If you've just done a short leg, the stopover is quite short because you don't need to do so much. Having said that, the stopover in New Zealand was a month, which is way too long. But it's to give you a chance. You're now halfway around, so any repairs you've got to do with the team, the crew, the boat, whatever, you can do there. But the boats were much faster than the race committee, I think, had realised. So we were getting to the stopovers a lot quicker. And a month. And this is the thing, this is why I love non-stop around the world sailing so much, because the stopovers in the end become quite disruptive. And you get into it, and I guess you understand exactly what I'm saying here. So you get into your stride, you forget the outside world, you're completely focused, you know, you've got a single sideband radio to port said radio as your only link with the outside world in the days before, you know, all these comms. and it's just you. It's you and the team and the ocean. And it's the most pure form of living, if you like. I mean, it's just, it's an extraordinary experience. And of course, you get into stop over. I mean, you're happy with the first night, you know, you go to the pub, you eat normal food instead of freeze dried, and you know, you like that. And then a week later, you're, you know, and it, you tend to get as well, this is interesting. So all the other crews are males, and they've all got their wives and girlfriends arriving. We're all female. We've got our husbands and boyfriends. So actually, none of us are married, all boyfriends arriving. And what we found was the girls would be assimilated into the team, the male team. And what was happening was with us was our boyfriends were trying to peel us off like sheepdogs, peel us off from the herd, and, you know, sort of take us off on our own. We're like, no, we're a team. We live together, we sleep together, we eat together, we need to be like this. And that was quite weird, but, you know, something we had to get through. So the stopovers can be a distraction, but you have to have them in this race.
Yeah, I totally get that. It's like when you're on those long legs, whatever it is that you're doing, you sort of do always look forward to that designate.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic-butter shrimp scampi. Mm. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
It's stopover or you know that moment of rest and recuperation and a change of scenery, and then actually they become an embuggerance, and you're in a bubble, then you're out of the bubble, and then you're like, yeah, you've got to reinsert, and you're like, oh, for God's sake. But yeah, I know, I totally get it. But sticking with the race then, we haven't got enough time to go through a lot of it, but can you talk about some of the highs and lows, particular legs or particular pieces of legs that really were a high, you know, there was much elation, but also ones that have included some terrifying moments? Because obviously you're at one with the sea, and I know only too well that thing, the ocean, can bite you in the arse.
Oh, yeah. And she's always right there, ready to do that. So the first leg was obviously trial for us. You know, journalists were taking bets as to how far we'd get before we sank or died. There was a book on that, and but our project manager actually had quite a lot of money in it for us, and so we won. So we entered the first leg in third place. Now, we were gutted, and this was the thing: we were a professional racing team in our heads, but in no one else's heads. We were a bit of a novelty, you know, side check. So we were third, gutted. Everyone else was like, oh, you're alive. Oh, this is amazing. You managed to sail across the ocean. We're like, oh, for God's sake. So we had this really weird, you know, it's a situation where we're gutted and everyone else is delighted. So we were kind of pretending we were delighted as well. The second leg for us was the big one. We knew we could win this leg, made into heavy boats. We knew we were going to be extreme, and we went the furthest south of any boat in that race. And I made a very conscious decision. We were going to take big risks. I said to the crew, I think we can do this. I want to take big risks. And everyone's like, yeah, absolutely, let's do it. When we saw our first iceberg about a couple of miles away without seeing it on the radar, we might have slightly changed our minds at that point, but we're like, no, it'll be fine. So that leg was, I mean, horrendous, but the sailing's amazing. The adrenaline is, you know, as you very well know, it's hard to live on adrenaline all the time. You know, you have to come down off that. And in a 5 week leg of total heightened awareness, it's quite hard. So that you get exhausted quite quickly. It's very draining. You get very few days, which are just the sort of a normal day sailing. And someone did actually die on this leg, which, you know, that reminds you. You're romping through the Southern Ocean, taking all these risks and, you know, racing. And then a guy went over the side on another boat. And that's when you think, okay, we're mortal. And let's just remember where we are. But when we got to the end of the second leg, we won that leg. So for me, that was one of the best moments of my entire life, because the shock value was just off the scale. I mean, it wasn't for us. We were like, yeah, we've done here what we set out to do. But there were literally mouths dropping open. I think the Royal Yacht Squadron nearly fell down. You know, so it was this just mammoth change in people's minds. I mean, not everyone's minds. You know, a lot of people are like, oh, it's just luck, beginner's luck. But Bob Fisher, who had written before we started the race, and Guardian journalist, they're just a tin full of tarts. When we won,
oh, yeah, the journalist from the Guardian.
Holy shit. I know. But when we won the leg into Australia, then we won the short leg into New Zealand, which proved we could do a long heavy leg and we could do a short tactical leg. And we won not just by, but very convincingly. We were over a day ahead at the halfway point. And so Bob Fisher wrote in Yachts and Yachting this time, not just a tin full of tarts, a tin full of smart, fast tarts. So we were like, I mean, we were delighted until someone points out, you know, the word tarts is still in that sentence. And we're like, small steps, small steps. So the rest of the race for us was not as good, unfortunately. We went back into the Southern Ocean and there just wasn't the heavy airs that we wanted. So we were lagging a little bit coming up to Cape Horn. I made a really annoying navigational mistake coming up to Cape Horn, put us in not a great position. But when we went around Cape Horn, fine. But then when we started coming up to the coast of South America, we hit a low pressure like none of us have ever known. And we went head into a storm. We started to take on water. We couldn't tell where it was coming from. It was serious. We sent out, not a Mayday, but we scrambled the Falkland Islands, who sent out a Hercules just to kind of get our where we were, make sure we were okay. So they were standing by for a Mayday. And for me, and it's interesting actually, because people who, I don't know, maybe haven't been through anything like that at all are like, oh my God, well, you must have been frozen with fear. And you're like, no, actually, that comes after. As you know, again, when you are in this situation, you just, nothing else matters except survival and your team. So all I could think about was, how do we get through this? And it didn't occur to me to be frightened. I didn't have time to be worried or frightened. I mean, I was worried. And I lied through my teeth, if I'm honest. The first time I've ever lied to my team, I said, listen, this is fine. Don't worry. Yep, we're going to sort this. And in my head, I'm thinking, I don't know if we are going to sort this. Of course, there's no one there to... It's you. You've got to do it. There's no repair people out there to help you. So we did not want to go into the Falklands if we could possibly help it. And in the end, we kind of sussed out that if we sailed at a certain angle, that we weren't taking in as much water. The bilge pumps broke. And you know that saying, there is no bilge pump like a bucket in the hands of a frightened sailor? Very true. Those buckets, I was in the nav station, the buckets were whizzing first, you know. So we got through that. I mean, I'm joking about it now, but I certainly wasn't at the time. And then about a day later, the sort of the nervous laughs come in and you're like, that was close. But the moment's gone, you've got through it. When we got into Fort Lauderdale, we did the swimsuit thing, which everyone remembers. So we felt that we'd earned our right to wear whatever the hell we wanted to wear when we sailed into port. And we were always very clear with this project. We're not blokes. We don't want to be blokes. We don't want to be male clones. We're girls. And we like being girls. And we like looking pretty. So when we sailed into Fort Lauderdale in swimsuits, that caused, of course, the biggest roar of the entire race, I think. And then the final leg back to the UK, where we didn't manage to, we'd slipped into second place. We didn't manage to get first place back. But of course, when we sailed into Southampton on the 28th of May, 1990, Bank Holiday Monday, we just sailed into this flotilla of boats coming out to see us in the Solent. I mean, it was, I've never seen anything like it. I'll never see anything like it again. 600 boats, say it really close to us, throwing flowers, beer, you know, and just incredible. And I think that was the moment we thought, oh, I think we might have done something here. You know, maybe we've changed people's minds and maybe, you know, we've done something good here. And then we came into Ocean Village and there were 50,000 people all chanting Maiden. I mean, it was just an amazing, amazing day. I have to say, though, that it's really not until 30 years later when we saw the film that was made very recently that we realised what we'd achieved. It's taken us that length of time for the whole sort of thing to sink in.
That's mad, isn't it? 30 years for something to sink in. And, like, I mean, that's... I sort of got a bit emotional then at the end. That was really... I mean, it is an amazing thing, you know, that whole, the whole process, when you think, look back on it and what you, you know, the beginning idea, you know, the idea itself, and then actually getting to the start line and then proving people wrong is in itself an amazing feat. But when you look at it all as one, it is unbelievable. I just wanted to go back a little bit because you said that you were, so for people that don't, might not know, Cape Horn is renowned for being horrific. It is just a part of the world that sailors fear. They have done for thousands of years, no doubt, but definitely for the last thousand, it's been feared. You said that you rounded Cape Horn and it was okay, which means I should imagine I know what's coming. The way I see it, because I've done stuff like this before. You hear about a horrendous place, you get to it, and you're like, what is all the hype all about? So you get round it, and you're like, all right, we're home plane sailing, I bet. You were lulled into a false sense of security and then you got smashed. And that's, I'm sitting here laughing because I know exactly the sort of emotion of getting round. You probably got round Cape Horn and thought,
Cape Horn.
Yeah, unbelievable.
Horn went, I don't think so.
Yeah. What happened to the boat then there? Did you find out?
We did, yeah, we found out in the end. So we had two problems. We had a split in the tank. So it was actually fresh water that was leaking into the boat, which mixed with the salt water, we didn't really realise. But we also had a crack in one of the pipes, which had frozen in the Southern Ocean and, of course, was starting to thaw out. And the crack went from the cockpit through the boat and out of the side. Of course, it was venting into the boat. We fixed everything in Uruguay, so it was fine.
Right, okay. So you've finished. I mean, there's an amazing response, all those people coming out to see you. And now, what was you've already spoken about, was it Bob Fisher? What was the media's take on it all? Was there any negative press, or was it a mixed bag?
It was mostly positive. I mean, we were on the front page of every newspaper. There were some really great articles written about us, actually, Best of British, and most journalists, there were a couple that were just couldn't drop it, but who cares about them? Most of them were generous and magnanimous in their, you know, sort of, okay, I completely got that wrong. And it was mostly really, really great. Interestingly, though, and this is, I know, something that you have spoken about before. This is probably the first year I've ever talked about the whole mental health issue at the end of something like that. And for you know, for most of my life after that, I never spoke about it because you didn't. You know, I'm strong and I'm invincible and I can't talk about, you know, any weakness. And I felt, especially as a woman, actually. So at the end of the race, you're on this, as you know, you're on this massive high. You can't get any higher. The buzz. And this happens, this goes on for 2 or 3 days. And then pretty much the entire fleet disappears. So all of these people that you've spent pretty much 2 years with, they're gone. I sold the boat. The boat was gone. I had to. The girls are gone off to their next race and their next job. And I hung around to write the book and do the talks and really kind of keep the whole Maiden thing alive. And it was not a sensible idea. So without any support, without any advice, in those days it didn't exist. You know, I just kept going. And when I think about it now, I mean, I didn't stop really for 5 years, literally. And I was not taking care of myself and, you know, working maybe doing three talks a day. And I fell off the cliff and I had a massive breakdown, which I say I haven't really spoken about until recently, because I think it's important. People like you and sports people are talking about mental health. It's important for people to see people who they think are invincible, that no one is. And if we don't ask for help and if we don't talk about this stuff, you know. And so I had a nervous breakdown and disappeared off down to Wales, divorced. I'd been married a month at that point. At the end of the race, when my boyfriend and I got married, we went through a horrendous time. We got divorced, which was then when the bad press started, because they were like, excellent, you know, yeah, let's get stuck into that. And I disappeared off to Wales and I became a recluse for 2 years. And it's interesting now that the film is out, people saying, why don't I know about this if it was so big? I think it's because I disappeared and the whole thing just, you know, went a bit flat. The people in the sailing world were going, where's she gone? You know, and I just literally disappeared off the face of the earth.
It's funny you mentioned that. I don't mean to butt in, but I just, while it's fresh in my head, you know, as a soldier, we always used to talk about coming back from something and decompressing. And we didn't, I didn't do it actually. But it's the same for all sort of events that last a bit of time and that are quite highly stressful and are an emotional roller coaster. I'm putting into that category as well people that go on expeditions, adventures, and that. You do need to have a period of decompression to take stock of your own self and emotions. Whereas you probably, I would suggest for those 5 years, you probably relived that entire process over and over and over again and never really were able to check it. Not that that's a bad thing. It is what it is. It's not, not changing. But it definitely, you know, for people that are listening to this, when you go and do things and when significant things happen in your life, you should really, after the event, take stock and just check in with yourself and see how you feel about it.
Absolutely. And no, you're right. And ask for help. I mean, that is something, it's taken me a lot of my adult life to learn how to ask for help, that it's not a weakness to ask for help. And the other thing, and it's interesting actually, all of my experiences with Maiden, then in my next project, which was the first all-female crew to attempt the non-stop round the world record, I then put together the world's first mixed gender racing team, 125-foot catamaran, and then did an event in Qatar, which was a nightmare. But through all of the last 30 years, yeah, let's not go there, and really don't go there. So over the last 30 years, I have learned, without realising, all these different bits from these projects. And I think, you know, you said how are you dealing with lockdown? And for me, it's realizing that every single thing in my life has helped me build resilience. And I think it's interesting that I think for the first time ever, I've realized resilience isn't necessarily something you're born with. It's something you can learn and develop. Learning to ask for help has been, I wouldn't have got through lockdown if I hadn't learned how to do that. And also giving, as you just said, giving yourself that space and time to be you. You know, I would say things like, oh, I don't have time for a holiday. I can't take a weekend off. I can't do this, I can't do that. Now I will, so my office is in my house, but I will shut the door at the weekend. I will say, I'm having a weekend off. I'm going to mow the lawn. I'm going to, you know, do this, do that. I'm not going to open my laptop. And it is, you know, we've this modern life that we've lived, and you were saying earlier, you know, it's in quarantine, you're reading, taking time, looking around. This has been that opportunity to do that. I mean, it's been a horrible, you know, sort of way that this has all happened. But how we use this time, I have found really interesting, you know, talking to friends and colleagues. I think it's life experiences now dictate how we manage these situations.
Yeah, definitely. Okay, so I want to move on to the basically what's been dominating your life for quite a bit of time now. And I think we met a few years ago, didn't we? And it was, I think it was
just at the beginning of the project when we met.
I think it was. And if I remember rightly, we actually went to the Jordanian, we went to a travel
Yeah, it was for the Jordanian ambassador. Lovely man.
There we go. Yeah, who you're good friends with. That's right. Yeah. So, right. Can you explain to people what happened to your boat and what you done, what you're doing with it, what the project is?
So I had Stella at the end of the race, and we still had no money. We never had any money. So she went off. I sold her to a really lovely couple, but unfortunately he died. She had to sell the boat. And so as I was off doing my things, I was sort of keeping an eye on where she was, and she was getting sadder and sadder and older, and point looking after her. And then 5 years ago, the same week, and this is so weird, so this particular week, I was looking for something to do. I'd finished the project that I'd just done, which is online safety with kids, and I wanted to go back in some sort of sailing. And that week, I met Alex Holmes, who decided to make the documentary. And also that week, I had an email from a mariner in the Seychelles saying, do you know that your beautiful boat has been sitting here for the past 2 years rotting? I'm like, what? So this guy had run out of money, left her there, and flown home. So they said, we've been trying to maintain her, but you know, if nothing happens, we're going to take her out and sink her because she's not even worth scrap. I was like, whoa, no woman left behind and 13th crew member, and not going to happen. So I called all the original crew and we set up a crowdfunder and we raised the money to buy her again and rescue her again. So we then had to find the money to get her back. And yeah, it was the beginning, the buzz of the beginning of a new project. You know, what are we going to do with this one? So that was exciting. And then again, Jordan came into the frame just after we bought her, and I'm thinking, how am I going to afford to ship her back? And I can't sail her, she's in too bad a condition. I was booked to do a travel talk in the Dead Sea in Jordan, and the woman who'd organized it said, hey, you just rescued Maiden. I went, yeah. She went, let's go and do a press conference in Amman. I'm like, okay. We drove 4 hours to Amman. She put on this huge press conference and didn't think anything more of it, came home, and then got a phone call from this beautiful voice at the end of the phone said, I hear you've rescued Dad's boat. And I went, Dad's boat? It's like Princess Haya. So it was his daughter who'd heard from Prince Ali that we'd rescued Maiden. She said, what can I do to help? It's like, thank you so much. She is her father's daughter. I mean, she's, yeah. So she said, right, yeah. So she funded the shipping and the complete restoration, and boy did she need a complete restoration again. This is definitely the last time I rescued this boat. And so she looks stunning, I mean, as she was, but even more beautiful. And she pretty much as she was, that we've updated the nav station, we really couldn't go with that old stuff. So we then, well, what are we going to do with her? And this was in, so we had her ready by summer of 2018, just when the film was coming out, bizarrely. We thought, well, we'll do this three-year world tour and we'll raise funds for girls' education. Girls' education has been a passion for me. I know, bizarrely, since I didn't use my education, but now realise actually how important it is and how I could really use one when I wanted to get a proper job. So I've learned so much over the last few years. 130 million girls around the world currently don't have an education. COVID-19 is going to make that worse, because when schools return at the end of this nightmare, the group of girls least likely to return, the group of children least likely to return, are disadvantaged girls. That's a number that's set to get worse. So, you know, there's all these amazing stuff that I've learned, like if a girl has 12 years of education, every girl has 12 years of education. We could cut child marriages by 64%. You know, we could cut infant mortality rate. We could cut the spread of AIDS, and for every disease in the world. You educate a girl, you educate her family, her community, a country. You increase the socioeconomic status of everyone around her. So this went from just educating girls to, oh my God, actually, this is changing the world. And, you know, we do like to do a project where we're changing the world. So Maiden is now sailing around the world on 3 year world tour, while she's not at the moment, obviously. We've got a new, younger version of us. They are more qualified. They're more amazing. They are, you know, so confident. And a lot of the women we have on the boat were inspired by Maiden to start sailing. And now they're on Maiden. So that's amazing, playing their part. And Yeah, so we sail into port, we raise funds for community programs, which we support. We've supported over the last year and a half community programs all over the world, which enable girls into education in developing countries and keep them in education in developed countries. Between the ages of 15 and 18, a lot of girls drop out of school. So we maiden sails into port, she inspires. We have a fan club. Maiden has a fan club. They're much more excited to see her than they are to see me. And as I say, we raise funds, we show the film, we go into schools, we have hundreds of kids down on the boat. We don't just reach out to girls, we reach out to boys, because we're saying to the boys, look, these girls are equal to you. And I have to say, with the younger generation, hopefully, I think we're pushing against an open door. There feels like a real change happening, you know, with the younger generations. My favorite conversation on the boat ever was in LA, two little tots sitting in the wheel well, a little boy and a little girl. The little boy turns to the little girl and he goes, "Is it only girls that can sail around the world then?" And then I thought, oh, this is just the best sentence ever. And she looked at him and she went, "I suppose boys can do it as well." It's just like, yes.
that conversation would never have happened 30 years ago.
A million years, no. So it's a great project. We love doing what we do. I mean, I feel like the luckiest person in the world, you know, mixing all of my favourite things together, empowering women, educating girls, sailing, you know, doing all the things we're doing. And, you know, we have a message of hope, which kids write messages to other kids around the world that goes around in a baton, which is a baton relay, goes on Maiden. The kids whose messages we get, we choose, they all put their hands on the spinnaker. So we have this beautiful spiral of hands from children all over the world. So yeah, we've done 33,000 miles. We had visited, I think it's over 30 destinations in, I can't remember how many countries, 22, I think it was, when everything came to a halt. And we're now just fundraising to keep going until we can begin again, probably in April next year, I think.
That's unbelievable. It's awesome. Where can people follow you? Where can people follow Maiden?
Yep. So I'm going to show you the website there. So it's strategically positioned by my daughter, I have to say. So it's www.themaidenfactor.org, so the Maiden Factor. And the reason it's called the Maiden Factor is that when we took her out of the water, when we got her back to Hamble, the guy that drives the travel lift that lifts the boats out, he looked sort of vaguely familiar. And I said, how long have you worked here? He said, I put Maiden in the water 33 years ago. He said, and I'm now here to take her back out again. I went, oh, that's amazing. He said, it's a bit dusty in the yard today, isn't it? I went, yeah, it's a lot dusty for a lot of people, actually. And he looked at me and he said, that's the Maiden Factor. And I went, oh, I'm so going to steal that for the name of my next project. So that's who we are, the Maiden Factor.
That's awesome. I mean, Trace, you've got an amazing story. You've met the Queen. You're an MBE, deservedly so. But what is it that still, we're coming to the end now. So there are a few canned questions and then I move on to readers' questions. So I ask people if they want to chuck in their own questions at the end. But I mean, it's going to be pretty obvious, but what is it that still motivates you?
I think at the root of everything I've ever done is the word justice. And because I do interviews and conversations where I'm required to boil everything down to one word, and equality didn't quite say it all for me. So justice for me, I think, is something that's always driven me. I cannot abide injustice anywhere for any reason. Humans, animals, men, women, colours, religions, I keep saying all those words, but for me they mean everything. And I think, you know, if justice means equality across the board, that is what drives me. And if I leave this earth without having done every single thing that I can do to make sure that my daughter and her daughter do not have to go through what we went through, then I will have failed. So, you know, for me, it's there's no easy stop to this, because it keeps going. You know, yes, things have changed in 30 years, but we still have casual sexism. You know, I still hear stories about girls who can't get onto boats. I still hear stories of extraordinary women sailors getting on a boat and being told, "Oh, make the tea, love, will you?" You know, so yeah. This is what drives me. And it's not an angry, "Oh, I must do this" kind of thing. It's just an absolute need and a passion. And, you know, if something has to drive me, it seems like as good a thing as any.
Yeah, agreed. I am 100% with you on that one. Now, you are an amazingly inspiring person. Your story inspires me, you inspire me, but who's the most inspirational person you've ever met?
I've ever met? Oh my goodness. Well, my mum and King Hussein have had the most impact on my life as you know, inspirational people go. People who are alive, or I have so many people inspire me. There's an amazing group of young women that are incredibly inspiring at the moment, who are fighting for our, you know, saving the planet. So you've got Greta Thunberg, you've got Vanessa Bash in yeah. Africa. Emma Gonzalez, the young lady in America who's fighting for gun control. I think I'm incredibly inspired by young people these days, and I feel ashamed that they have to have these battles, that we failed them so badly, but I'm inspired by them.
Yeah, that's a great answer. Basically, the person's question that I gets picked out wins a bottle of Talisker. I think it's Daffid D. Gibby. And the question is, as an experienced motivational speaker, you've given many people advice and words of wisdom over the years. What's the best advice you've ever been given? And also, what's the worst advice you've ever been given?
Best piece of advice I've ever been given was by my mum, who I steal all of her quotes. She said to me, just before I left for Greece, she said, "Remember, there are two facts in life that are incontrovertible." So the first one is, if you stand still, nothing will ever happen. Nothing. It's impossible. If you keep moving forwards, something will happen. So it doesn't matter if you don't know where you're going. It doesn't matter if you don't understand the route or even the destination, but keep moving forwards, because if you're not moving forwards, nothing will ever happen. And that, I've lived my whole life through that, and it works.
That's a good bit of advice. I like it. And worst?
Worst piece of advice. Oh my goodness. I've been given so much bad advice in my life. I don't know where to start. let's put on a round the world race in Qatar. There you are. That's my worst advice ever.
Okay, there we go. Tracy, we've run out of time basically, so I'd like to just thank you for everything that you're doing, everything you've done. You're an amazing inspiration.
Thank you.
And I'm really proud that you could come on my podcast. So thanks.
Really nice to see you again.
Likewise, yeah. Thanks very much to Tracy, and I hope you enjoyed it. Don't forget to subscribe to the podcast if you don't already, and follow me and the Book of Man for the latest news. Thanks again to Talisker for supporting this podcast. And thanks to you all for listening. See you next time.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.